Conclusion: Strong bonds for a fragile planet. Queer utopias are not fantasies. Queer utopias are necessities. Black Lodge Press. In the closing scene of the final episode of the television series Friends, the six protagonists stand somberly in Monica and Chandler's empty Manhattan apartment, where they have all lived at some point, bidding it farewell. The couple have newborn twins and are moving to the suburbs. After Monica and Chandler place their keys on the counter, the others do the same. It turns out all of them still have a set. "So I guess this is it," says Phoebe to the forlorn group. "Yeah, I guess so," sighs Joey. Monica and Rachel start to cry, and everyone comforts each other. The end of an era scene is like a wake for friendship. I watched the Friends finale at 13, sobbing. Friends, which ran from 1994 to 2004, is one of the most watched television series of all time. Fan Steve Mazura proved his devotion by watching all 238 episodes for 80 hours straight, during which time he experienced nausea and hallucinations. During its reign, Friends reflected and infused popular consciousness. No surprise, then, that the show was overwhelmingly white and frequently problematic. It was, too, an unrealistic depiction of New York life, not least with regards to housing. It seems implausible that the Friends would have been able to afford their rent. As a child, though, I was not alert to the program's problematics. I was fixated on it for reasons I did not understand. Like many fans, I was invested in the characters' lives, internalizing their hopes and dreams to the extent that they distorted my own. In 2021, the Friends cast, now in their 50s, came together for a bizarre and somehow painful reunion show, which became the most watched broadcast ever on Sky One. During the almost two-hour-long eulogy, emotional fans from all over the globe describe how watching Friends helped them through loneliness, mental health crises, and grief. "It became a reason for me to wake up every day," says Nancy from Ghana, "because I felt I had friends around me." At one point, Malala is interviewed about her true addiction to the show. For better or for worse, Friends resonated with a lot of people. During the reunion, Friends co-creator Marta Kaufman explained why the series had to end when it did. "If the show was about that time in your life when your friends are your family, once you have family of your own, it's no longer that time. In this way," she concludes, "the program had a natural end." Friends addressed the value of friendship, and in the group's relationships, viewers could catch glimpses of enduring platonic intimacy, interdependent love beyond the couple form, and quasi-communal domesticity. Ultimately, however, all this was just a prelude. Friends lionized heteronormative happy endings. Ross and Rachel got back together. Monica and Chandler got their babies. Phoebe was married. Only eternal bachelor Joey remained uncoupled, perhaps because he was getting his own spin-off show. "It was really important to us to end everyone in a good place," reasoned co-creator David Crane. Just Friends. At 13, I thought I was so upset at Friends' ending because I would miss the ritual of watching it. Looking back, I think my distress had something to do with a vague sense that, in the Friends' seemingly preordained dispersal, their intimacy was being reneged, and other possible futures denied. As Kaufman's remark identifies, the demotion of friendship is naturalized in capitalist social relations. Friendship is ascribed less value than romantic and sexual relationships, the onset of which often signals the beginning of the end, or at the least, significant dilution of platonic bonds. Friendship is not necessarily thus. Intimacy is contingent. For example, from the 18th century to the early 20th in Europe and the United States, romantic friendship between women, among the bourgeois at least, was a well-recognized and prized kind of intimacy. Such friendships, whether or not they involved sex, entailed, according to the scholar of lesbian history, Lillian Faderman, passionate commitment. By the early 1900s, however, such relationships had become socially maligned, framed as a harmful distraction from heterosexual marriage. An 1895 book, Side Talks with Girls, by Ruth Ashmore, cautions women against having a girl sweetheart, which it claims would diminish the love available for Prince Charming when he comes to claim his bride. The ancient world, as Alexandra Kollontai charts, considered friendship and loyalty until the grave to be civic virtues. This changed, she argues, because bourgeois society was built on the principles of individualism and competition, and has no place for friendship as a moral factor. Friendship does not help in any way and may hinder the achievement of class aims. It is viewed as an unnecessary manifestation of sentimentality and weakness. Friendship becomes an object of derision. Today, if we are not romantically or sexually involved with someone, we are just friends. The established hierarchy for relationships, in favour of the romantic dyad and the nuclear family form, shrinks and demotes more various and comradely intimacies. This relational order can be insular and alienating, not only for those who are single, unable or undesirous to form a romantic partnership, but also for those who have done so and still find themselves longing for intimacy. Research shows that almost half the UK population experience feelings of loneliness. Half of all older people consider television their prime companion. People with long-term illness or disability are especially likely to feel lonely. The idea that being in a couple should fulfil all our intimate needs leads to desolation for many. The devaluation of our friendships creates an emptiness we may not see when we are devoting all our attention to finding someone to love romantically or giving all our attention to a chosen loved one, writes bell hooks. And the cultural norm of neglecting friendships harms romantic partnerships in turn. As Hooks writes, committed love relationships are far more likely to become codependent when we cut off all our ties with friends to give these bonds we consider primary our exclusive attention. Friendship is conceived of as, and therefore often is, a shallower bond than a romantic partnership. As Carla Bergman and Nick Montgomery put it, under neoliberalism, friendship is a banal affair of private preferences. We hang out, we share hobbies, we make small talk. Under neoliberal friendship, we don't have each other's backs and our lives aren't tangled up together. Empire works to usher its subjects into flimsy relationships where nothing is at stake and to infuse intimacy with violence and domination. Though we may be lacking intimacy in the flesh, on social media we are pushed to add friends, people we may scarcely know, to our network and to share personal updates with them. In 2014, the ART campaign, Wages for Facebook, attempted to disrupt the appropriation of human relationships for profit by corporations like Facebook. Repurposing the Wages for Housework manifesto, the Wages for Facebook website announces, "They say it's friendship. We say it's unwaged work. With every like, chat, tag or poke, our subjectivity turns them a profit. They call it sharing, we call it stealing. We've been bound by their terms of service far too long. It's time for our terms." Wages for Facebook is only the beginning, but its message is clear. From now on, they have to pay us, because as users, we do not guarantee anything any longer. We want to call work what is work, so that eventually we might rediscover what friendship is. Whilst digitized friending is cajoled by tech companies, other attempts at friendship are maligned and even criminalised. As we have heard, the state, offering rhetorical or material encouragement or coercion, approves of some relational forms, the biological family, the couple, the marriage, the nuclear family. It is ostensibly disinterested, meanwhile, in friendship, which is for the most part invisible in legal and policy frameworks. This apparent oversight is redressed, however, when the state considers friendship a threat to the prevailing social order. Gatherings of friends in public space, for example, are treated differently depending upon the class and race of those present. A group of working class, houseless or black people socialising on the streets or in a park are much more likely to face stigma and police harassment than a group of middle class white people drinking Prosecco on a picnic blanket. For some people in the UK today, observes writer Luke de Narona, friendship is dangerous. For young black men and boys in heavily policed urban areas, having friends is dangerous, not because they endanger you, but because the police deem your friendships dangerous and can criminalise you for them. Whilst being identified as a gang member by the police does not correspond to criminality, it can block access to housing, education and employment, and increasingly it carries the threat of deportation. The racist gang narrative is harnessed by the state to forge group culpability. Young black men are disproportionately charged under joint enterprise laws, meaning they become guilty by association. In May 2021, Manchester Crown Court found 10 black boys guilty of conspiracy to murder and grievous bodily harm. Though none of them killed anyone, they all now face lengthy prison sentences. The prosecution and press labelled the 10 boys a gang, but what in fact connected them was the murder of a childhood friend. Evidence used against them included text messages expressing their grief and anger at the loss of their friend, as well as rap lyrics. The policing of gangs, writes De Narona, constitutes the criminalization of friendship. The racist gang narrative is used to criminalize allegiances that are not amenable to state power. De Narona suggests that gangs are so troubling for the state because they refuse the nation and make meaning and fellowship otherwise, because they do social reproduction wrong. Some forms of kinship threaten nation building and capital by embracing the wrong values and social forms. Friendship in and against the state. Like all kinds of relationships, friendship is shackled by capitalism. To liberate it, argue Bergman and Montgomery, we must recognise that, just as intimacy and closeness can be enabling, they can also be sources of coercion, manipulation, and exploitation. To insist on, seek out, or use friendship, and to pathologise its refusal, tends to reinforce these divisions and hierarchies rather than unravel them. How can friendship instead be an emancipatory source of connection, care, and community? How can we build friendships that hold and sustain us as we collaborate for better futures? As the writer, educator, and trainer for transformative and disability justice, Mia Mingus, puts it, any kind of systematic change we want to make will require us to work together to do it, and we have to have relationships strong enough to hold us as we go up against something as powerful as the state, the medical industrial complex, the prison system, the gender binary system, the church, immigration system, the war machine, and global capitalism. To transform the world, we're going to need strong links between us. We must, as Mingus says, live out the simple truth that we need each other. For all the ways friendship is relegated and attacked, it might evade being pinned down and instead grow wings. At its best, friendship could be a liberatory relationship, one in which we can share and lessen the load of being alive. As Bergman and Montgomery suggest, friendship as freedom names a dangerous closeness that capitalism works to eradicate through violence, division, management, and incitements to see ourselves as isolated individuals or nuclear family units. Foucault considers friendship's potential for counterpower in relation to homophobia, suggesting this hate is less about sex and more about society's unease with the modes of affection, tenderness, friendship, fidelity, camaraderie, and companionship that queerness spawns, as incongruous with established moulds for kinship. Dominant nodes of power, he argues, fear this kind of friendship because it represents the formation of new alliances and the tying together of unforeseen lines of force. The unwieldiness of friendship, understood as polyvalent intimacy that defies hierarchy, formalization, and state sanction, could be its power. In exploring this idea, we need not overhaul our established relationships. Relationships tend to resist categorization anyway, whatever their labels. A couple apparently has sex, but many such relationships don't fit that definition. Marriage is understood as a bond of profound emotional connection, which it often is not. A parent-child relationship is supposed to entail unfaltering care, but does not always. As we all know, relationships are complicated. Queer relationships are more likely to embrace ambiguity because queer people know that normative standards for real relationships, like being straight, are a farce. If the nuclear family is more a site of harm and rejection than of love, different forms of kinship might be made more intentionally, allowing for more fluidity. Writer and performer Alok Vaid Menon describes this beautifully in their poem Friendship is Romance. They write, I want a world where friendship is appreciated as a form of romance. I want a world where when people ask if we are seeing anyone, we can list the names of all of our best friends and no one will bat an eyelid. I want monuments and holidays and certificates and ceremonies to commemorate friendship. I want a world that doesn't require us to be in a sexual and or romantic partnership to be seen as mature, let alone complete. I want a movement that fights for all forms of relationships, not just the sexual ones. I want thousands of songs and movies and poems about the intimacy between friends. I want a world where our worth isn't linked to our desirability, our security to our monogamy, our family to our biology. Recently, the term queer platonic partner has gained popularity. For some, this is an over-articulation of friendship. For others, it is a cherished descriptor for relationships that go deeper than what is commonly understood by friendship. Queer platonic partnerships might be loving commitments, involving entwinements that are ordinarily considered beyond the pale of just friends, perhaps cohabiting, sharing resources, fulfilling next of kin roles, or co-parenting. Bell Hooks, who described queer as the self that is at odds with everything around it, wrote abundantly about the latent power of friendship as a flexible kind of love. Many women come to recognize, she argues, that heterosexual marriage alone leaves them hungry for connection. We may long for deep and abiding intimate bonds of communion and love that are not sexual, and yet we want these bonds to be honored, cherished commitments to bond us as deeply as marriage vows. This kind of friendship can be both enduring and transformative, she writes, because even if we make significant commitments to other people, to spouse or children, for example, it can change but need not be broken. Having deep and profound connections in friendship, she argues, strengthens all our intimate bonds. With its outward-looking proclivities, in comparison to the typically insular couple form and nuclear family, friendship can incubate solidarity, and vice versa. The Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners, or LGSM group, formed to fundraise for the 1984-5 miners' strike, exemplifies political co-conspiration through friendship. After a bucket collection at the London Pride March, co-founders Mike Jackson and Mark Ashton convened a meeting from which LGSM, and subsequently Lesbians Against Pit Closures, or LAPC, grew, with groups forming across the UK. Amid the homophobia and economic cruelty of Thatcher's reign, LGSM and LAPC members joined hands with miners. Despite some initial suspicion and even hostility among the miners in receipt of the funds raised by lesbian and gay activists, striking workers from the Dulles Valley in Wales sent a representative, David Donovan, to London to meet with LGSM. Together with LGSM members, Donovan went to a lesbian and gay pub for the first time in his life to speak to patrons who had donated to the strike fund. After telling the crowd of around 200 about the miners' struggle, he said, "I have been asked by the people of the Dulles Valley to extend the hand of friendship and solidarity to the lesbian and gay comrades and friends in London." In turn, LGSM and LAPC members were welcomed by mining communities, where they were greeted by a party at the Miners' Welfare Hall. Recalling the evening of festivities, LGSM activist Robert Kincaid wrote that a riotous time was had by all, with gay and lesbian activists and people from the local mining community dancing and kissing each other. LGSM and LAPC activists described the collective joy as one of the most moving experiences of all our lives. Nurturing solidarity that is not only politically attuned but intimate can deepen our commitment to radical action. If our bonds are, as Bergman and Montgomery describe, crucial to life, worth fighting for, our struggle should reflect these highest of stakes. Sprawling intimate commitments unsettle the capitalist state, chipping away at its attempts to cash power by divide and rule. Caring for each other in indeterminate ways builds power from below, pushing back against oppressive forces. It makes sense that the state would look to undermine such bonds, especially when they straddle borders. It is no surprise, de Noronha notes, that there is no such thing as a friendship visa. If friendship interrogates established hierarchies and forms of domination in society and therefore between us, it won't be easy. Cultivating radical intimacy entails transformation of the self, of our relationships, and of the world. And transformation towards brighter horizons happens through struggle with each other and in the context of structural violence. We cannot do this without acknowledging that we, all of us, hold the potential for harm. As Mingus writes, "We're going to mess up. Of that, I am sure. We cannot, on the one hand, have sharp analysis about how pervasive systems of oppression and violence are, and then, on the other hand, expect people to act like that's not the world we exist in. Of course there are times we are going to do and say oppressive things. Of course we are going to hurt each other. Of course we are going to be violent, collude in violence or accept violence as normal. We must roll up our sleeves and start doing the hard work of learning how to work through conflict, pain, and hurt as if our lives depended on it, because they do. And, as Audre Lorde wrote, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. We cannot adopt the same authoritarian and punitive methods as the state, lest we repeat the kinds of violence we want to abolish. Turning towards each other for justice and repair, refusing carceral logic, demands our commitment to healing and growth in ourselves and in each other. This means learning to navigate trauma, shame, and suffering. Failure to do so means risking our intimacies, and therefore our liberation struggles, as Mingus puts it, imploding from the inside. As we grow together, we might, as Adrienne Marie Brown suggests, see ourselves as microcosms of the world and work to shift oppressive patterns in our bodies, hearts, minds, speech, and interactions, liberating ourselves into purpose, liberating our communities into new practices. Believing radical change is possible means believing it is possible in our beings and our relationships too. Strong Bonds for a Fragile Planet. There is a piece of commissioned street art in my neighbourhood that says, "Spend your time together," in bold, colourful lettering. Underneath, someone has sprayed, "Easier for some than others." I first saw the words during a pandemic lockdown, reading them as a bleak reminder that many of us, through no fault of our own, are starved of intimacy. The ways we exist, are made to exist, under capitalism, do not support intimacy. Indeed, they are often designed to fracture it. As the pandemic laid bare, normative ways of doing kinship leave many alienated, suffering, and impoverished. And how we experience the intimate realm is shaped by our identities and material realities. A black man experiencing emotional distress will not receive the same kinds of care as a white cis woman. A queer refugee will have a different experience of home and family to a middle-class British queer person. Many spaces for intimacy via collective joy, such as nightclubs and protests, are not welcoming or accessible to disabled people. Left to its own devices, the world cannot hold us. The colliding global crises of capitalism, in ecological collapse and in the rising tide of fascism, threaten the fabric of communities and the lives that compose them. We must hold each other as we remake a world that can. How can we create the conditions for abundant intimacy for everyone? In the preceding chapters, I have explored some ideas, experiments, and actions that will hopefully provide inspiration, psychiatric abolition, and building collective care strategies such as crisis support plans, reconceiving family in more expansive ways that leave no one behind or overburdened, remaking home away from the private and insular towards communality, dismantling the supremacy of heteronormativity, for example, through a feminist movement that demands sexual freedom and safety for all, transforming our collective relationship to death by finding new ways to come together in grief, such as in public rituals and vigils against state violence. Radical intimacy means germinating connection, care, and community such that liberatory futures can unfurl. Because the world as we know it is hostile to intimacy, we must be intentional about finding ways to rupture alienation. Here are some examples. Befriending projects, such as that run by Opening Doors, which matches LGBTQ+ people aged 50+ with queer friends to combat isolation, taking up space on soulless commercialised streets with participatory creative pursuits, as does Street Scenes, a network that runs workshops like collage making for passers-by, erupting spaces for public hedonism in defiance of the state, like when Kill the Bill protesters gathered in May 2021 for a post-march rave in London's Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens. Intimacy holds radical potential because it is the kernel of being alive. Being conscious of the ways the world shapes, stifles, and crushes this kernel, then, is crucial to its transformation. Perhaps because intimacy is so essential to our being, it can be difficult to imagine it being otherwise. Let us feed and feed on utopian horizons. Let us come together in seizing our desires from the clutches of capitalism. Because we need stronger bonds to hold each other together and to keep the world from falling apart. Our mutual entwinement must be careful, spacious, and supple, with no single knot tied too tight. In this macrame of loving design, we might find the wisdom, purpose, and strength we need to weave new worlds. We hope you have enjoyed this Pluto Press audiobook of Radical Intimacy by Sophie K. Rosa, read by Lily Lefko. It was produced for Pluto Press by Sound Understanding. The text copyright is Sophie K. Rosa, 2023, and the production copyright is Pluto Press, 2023. All rights reserved. A full list of citations and notes can be referenced in the print and ebook editions. For more information about this and all of our unabridged audiobooks, please visit plutobooks.com. The end.